I saw something this morning saying that preachers need to be mindful of the time changes. We think about how long we're going to preach. But not only was I here for Bible class, not only did I get here on time, not only do I live with Millie, but we didn't have electricity this morning. And if I managed to do all that, I have zero sympathy for any of you. So if you do nod off, like I told Charlotte, I'll just come stand beside you while I preach until you figure out what's going on. This morning, we're going to be in the book of 2 Kings. So if you would, go ahead and be turning to 2 Kings chapter 18 is where we're going to start. But this is in the time of the divided kingdom. And so beginning with King Saul and then on to David and on to Solomon, the nation of Israel was a nation. They had their moments where they weren't so great, but as a whole, they were following God. But then after King Solomon, it split into what we tend to call the northern and southern kingdoms, the northern being Israel, the southern one being called Judah. Hezekiah was one of the kings of Judah, as Titan read in our text this morning. The author of 2 Kings chapter 18 puts Hezekiah pretty high on the list of kings that Judah had, that he was the best one that they ever had. This is about 200 years into the kingdom being split. The world power at the time is Assyria. They have already begun to take Israel, the northern kingdom, off into captivity. And Hezekiah is going to inherit a mess in the southern kingdom of Judah. His father has pretty much closed down the temple, closed down all sorts of worship. They have idols put up in their places. They've got Asherah poles. They've got all these different issues that they're dealing with. And Hezekiah comes in and he gets things turned around. And so that's going to be the first lesson we're going to get, is that Hezekiah was handed a terrible situation and he didn't say, well, I'll do the best I can, but every time there was a hiccup, just kind of go, well, I got inherited a bad mess, so you can't blame me. Almost like our regular presidential cycle, everything that good happens is theirs, but everything that's still bad was, well, I can't fix what the other guy had done. No, Hezekiah comes in, and he says, we're going to fix this. And so our lesson first then becomes, you can still inherit a terrible, dysfunctional situation and turn it into something good. Just because it starts bad doesn't mean you have to just keep it going and use that as a crutch as you struggle. Hezekiah comes in and he immediately turns things around. Maybe that's your situation with church. I don't know everybody here. I know that we have some people visiting. You might be going back to your home churches. Maybe you're looking for a church. And one of the things we tend to do in our American culture, our society, is whether we've been at a church for a while or whether we come to visit, we see problems that the church has because it's full of humans. It's going to have problems. And we go, oh, well, there's too many problems here. I need to go somewhere else and try to fix it there. Or they just feel like the problem's too much, and they're like, I can't be a part of that. I'm going to leave and go somewhere else. Or as someone who has been a lead minister myself, we can just look at it and go, oh, this church has got too many problems. I don't want to go there. That's too much for me to fix. Hezekiah immediately says, I'm going to fix this problem. One of the things that he does that I had either forgotten or never really learned is what he did in verse number 4 of chapter 18. He removes the high places, broke down the pillars, cut down the Asherah, all the things that were to these false gods. But then he broke in pieces the bronze serpents that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel made offerings to it. If you don't remember from the book of Numbers, when the people of Israel are grumbling about wishing they were still back in Egypt because they're in their 40 years of wandering, God sends these fiery serpents to come and bite them. And everyone who gets bit by the serpent, the serpents begin to die. And so they cry out to Moses saying, we're sorry, we should have been grateful. Will you please talk to God and fix this problem for us? And so God has him build a pole and puts a bronze serpent on it, and anybody who looks to that serpent will not die from their snake bites. So apparently they had kept this, the bronze serpent, as a reminder of what God had done, which is a great thing. They could look at that thing every time, whether it's in the temple, whether it's in the tabernacle, whatever the case was, they could look at it and go, oh yes, remember when God took us out of that terrible situation that we put ourselves in and rescued us. But instead, over the hundreds of years after this event, it had morphed into being something they were actually worshiping as an idol itself. They had put this snake up, and it seems as though they were bringing offerings to it. And one of the things Hezekiah has to do is to get rid of that. In the church, we call these the sacred cows. They're the things that maybe started out as something good, maybe had a great purpose for the church, but over time have morphed into something that's not good, in fact, has become something bad. But because people are so attached to it, we can't change it. We can't do anything different. Hezekiah recognized that something that was once good had been perverted and made into something bad, and he had no qualms about getting rid of it. And you know, there were people who were upset about this. There were people who had fond memories of their grandparents bringing them to this bronze snake and doing good with it, teaching them about when God did something great for his people. But over time, it had lost its purpose. It had turned into something negative. Those things find their way into our churches today. Their programs, their orders of worship, they are different items located within the church building. And they're things that we can't touch because so-and-so's grandpa did something with it. And maybe it was good to begin with, but it has turned maybe into something that's being a hindrance. As a true leader of God, Hezekiah didn't see that as an obstacle that he couldn't overcome because people might be upset. He stepped up and did what needed to be done. Think about your church, whether this is your church or whether you go to church somewhere else on a regular basis. We should always be on the lookout for the bronze serpent, the thing that we cling to because of that powerful drug we call nostalgia, or we just want to hang on to those memories, but it's become an obstacle. Hezekiah, as a true reformer, had no problem tearing it down. We as people of God must be willing to tear down the bronze serpents that find their way into our churches and into our lives. For a couple different examples of those, there's a story told, I've heard it told in multiple congregations, that there used to be a cloth they would put over the communion trays. And someone in the year 2015 said, we don't need this anymore, so they got rid of it. And it causes a massive problem, because people are upset because the cloth has always been there and we need to keep it because it's always been the thing we've done. And if you finally ask someone old enough in the congregation, they'll tell you, well, that was just to keep the flies off the communion because we didn't have AC back then. But it had been turned over time into something sacred that couldn't be touched because somebody once had an affinity for it. Church libraries often fall into this category. When I first came, not here, but to our church in Marshall, I asked, I've already accepted this job and we've moved. Where is my office? Oh yeah, we were supposed to clean out the library. There you go. So I had a whole library of books that literally had dust on every single one of them. But it turns out, after I moved all the books and made it my office, no one wanted to touch it because they all remembered the old lady that took care of it, even though no one did anymore. And so no one wanted to touch the sacred thing because someone had taken care of it, even though it was not used anymore. Those are the type of things that can become the bronze serpent that we have to be willing to say, if the church is going to move forward, they might need to be crushed. We have to be willing to examine and look for those sort of things. As time goes on, Hezekiah has to eventually deal with the problem of Assyria. And so I'm getting ahead of myself. And I also forgot a slide. We're not going to read it, but 2 Chronicles chapter 29, 30, and 31 takes place between 2 Kings 12 and 13. What we find is that one of the things Hezekiah has to do is fix the entire nation around worship. just because he's broken down the bronze statue and cleaned out the temple doesn't mean that things are just magically going to go back. So in chapter 29, he calls all the priests and all the Levites together, and they have a ceremony where they are cleansed, where they ceremoniously cleanse the temple and get it ready for worship. They bring in the musicians. They begin playing the worship music. They reinstitute sacrifices. They fix the entire order of worship for Israel. And chapter 30 finds Hezekiah then inviting the entire nation to come together so they can restart doing the Passover meal. They haven't been doing the Passover on a yearly thing, so they have this big kickoff party, if you will, where they invite everybody together and they reinstitute the Passover and have it all together. But then in chapter 31, as all those people go back to their homes and back to their areas within the kingdom of Judah, when they leave, that revival and that Passover changes them. And so they go home and go back to their local areas of worship, back to their homes, and they take the idols out. They take all this pagan stuff out because this Passover meal has changed them. They go back and they give tithes and they refill all the storehouses. And so the nation becomes more wealthy because they're following and listening to God. The message I want us to get from that is that if change is going to occur not only in our homes but in our churches, is it has to start with the leaders. It starts with the leaders coming together and saying, we have got to change things and get it on track. I'm talking to the elders. I'm talking to the deacons. I'm talking to everybody who's a ministry leader in some way, shape, or form. I'm talking to those of you who lead your connect groups. I'm talking to those of you who lead Bible classes. I'm talking to those of you who lead homes. I'm talking to those who lead sports teams, who lead classrooms, who have teammates, who have fellow students, who have fellow musicians. Every organization that you are a part of and have any influence over, if it's ever going to change, it starts at the top. It starts with those people rededicating their lives to getting things back to how God begins. Not to force everybody else to do it, but it starts by getting your life on track. And when your life is on track, when your conduct is on track, when your words are on point, you can then lead a spiritual change. Until we have all the leaders of our church together and we are leading this great spiritual worship, things won't change. But when spiritual worship is changed, when God's commands are followed, chapter 31, when the people leave the gathering and go back to their normal lives, they are changed. And they then change their everyday lives. One of the things I think we slip into is a mindset of coming here. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but on a Sunday morning, coming together, singing songs, praising God, taking communion together, hearing His word proclaimed, and then we go back the rest of our weeks like nothing happened, like nothing changed. But this great moment leads to people actually changing, not just when they're here when it's easy to be a Christian, but when it's back to the rest of their lives. And they're impacting the people around them. That's what true leadership drives. That's what this leadership can change. And so Hezekiah knows he needs to start with them, and that's where he begins his work. And when we change our homes, when we change our leadership in the church, when we change and get things in the direction of God, it just flows out. It becomes an overflow. And that begins to be how we change the world around us. Hezekiah, though, is going to have to deal with the world power of Assyria as they begin to knock on his door. And they begin to take over as they have done so many other times, as they have already done to the northern kingdom of Israel. Most of the rest of chapter 18 is about that struggle. Is about how Hezekiah knows the king is coming. He's taking over parts of his land. He's trying to give him gifts, hoping that he'll just kind of stay away. But as most bullies do, when you give them a little bit, they'll just keep coming back for a little more till they eventually want to take everything. Skip forward to 2 Kings chapter 19, verses 10, 11, and 12. He's been taunting the king, Hezekiah and his people, so he finally just goes ahead and sends letters taunting him. Verse number 9 ends with, "So he sent messengers again to Hezekiah, saying, 'Thus you shall speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands, devoting them to destruction. And shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, the nations that my father destroyed, Gozan, Haran, Resef, and the people of Eden who were at Tesalar?'" And he goes on and mentions a bunch of other kings, and he's saying, "I have taken out everybody I have wanted to. You know who they are. You've seen all the nations around you. Their gods couldn't save them. Their kings fell, and they're now under my control. What makes you think your puny god is any different than the rest of them? I am going to come right in here and take whatever I want." And he writes him a letter and sends it with a messenger just in case he forgets. But what Hezekiah does next becomes this great message of what it means when we're dealing with forces from the outside. So Vandy's going to come read for us verses 14 through 19 to see what Hezekiah's response is to this imminent threat that's coming his way.
Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all kingdoms of the earth. You have made the heavens and the earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your ears, O Lord, and see. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste to the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fires, for they were not God, but the work of man's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone."
So in this moment of great national security moments, he doesn't fight. He doesn't get all of his armies together or all of his generals and go, "Okay, what can we do to fend this off? Are we able to beat them?" He doesn't run. He doesn't run and hide. He doesn't try to bribe his way out of it. He doesn't cower. He doesn't try to send out people while he runs away. None of that. His first response is to turn to God. And I love that he literally takes his problems, these letters, and lays them out in front of him and says, "God, I give this to you. I have this very real physical representation of a threat, and I give it to you. I trust you. I know that you have led us through hard times time and time again. I know you're a God who is to be trusted. They are mocking you. What to do? I'm not sure, so I'll listen to you." What a powerful statement. And how much better would our lives be, especially in our spiritual battles, if we just laid it before God and said, "This is yours. What do I need to do?" That's what we tend to do after we've tried about 17 ways to do it Travis's way. When we've tried every way on our own, trying to figure out, "What can I do to get myself out of this? What can I do to help this situation? How can I do something?" When Hezekiah says, "I know I can't, but you can." And he brings it and sets it before God. This is so powerful that God sends Isaiah to him, who's pretty much been his prophet for his entire reign. And Isaiah comes to him and essentially says, "God has heard you. And God will do." If you skip forward to about verse 34, it kind of summarizes the message that Isaiah has for King Hezekiah. Verse 34, it says, "For I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." God says, "I heard, and I will show up." So verse 35, "And that night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And then when people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, and he went home." So he saw what he was up against was different than all the other gods he had steamrolled up to that point. That these people are something different. And he packed up and he went home because he said, I am up against something. I have no chance of being able to come over. When we bring our problems to God and we give it to him, Satan cannot do anything against it. It won't even be close. Satan may have steamrolled every other group of people. Every other type of institution may be under Satan's control. But when we turn and just give it to God, God will be there for us. And God will handle this if we're willing to give it to him and listen. That becomes how we can handle these great destructions. Because a lot of times when we think about different issues in the world and we're drawn in or tempted to get sucked in to the culture war, and we want to fight back and we want to push that, we just somehow force things onto people. We want to force prayer into schools. We want to force posters of the Ten Commandments. We want to force these things because we need to take our country back. And Hezekiah says, Lord, I give it to you. I will let you handle this because I can't change hearts, but you can, God. I can't force people to change their hearts, but you can, God. And as we see in the next story, this is a regular practice of King Hezekiah. In chapter 20, he's going to find himself on his deathbed. He's about age 39, verse number 1 of chapter 20. In those days, Hezekiah became sick and was at the point of death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came to him and said, thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die, you will not recover. So whatever issue he had, whatever sickness he had, literally brought him to his deathbed. And God said, yeah, it looks like you're going to die, and that's right, because you are. So set things in order. You've got a whole kingdom, figure out how it's going to run once you're gone, because you're at death's door. And so Hezekiah does what Hezekiah does. He turns to God. Taya's going to read for us verses 2 through 6 of what Hezekiah does in response to a very grave message that he has been given.
Then Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, saying, now, O Lord, please remember how I have walked before you in faithfulness and with a whole heart and have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. And before Isaiah had gone out of the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him. Turn back and say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David, your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Behold, I will heal you. On the third day, you shall go up to the house of the Lord, and I will add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you in this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake and for my servant David's sake.
He does the same thing. He brings it to God. He immediately doesn't try to figure out how to fix this, how to prolong his life. He just says, God, can we do something about this? I often turn to this story as an example of what prayer can do. Prayer can change things. I often go to this story to talk about how God hears prayer and does things about prayer. But this is where Hezekiah's story takes a turn for the worse. When I read this story, again, maybe I had just forgotten before I sat down and studied this last week, but I had always just kind of left the story there. It's a great story. God gave him 15 more years. But what we do with the answer to our prayers is almost, if not just as important as praying them to begin with. Because look at what he does with this answer to his prayer. Skip down to verse number 12, chapter 20. At that time, this guy, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sends envoys with letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. So what, despite Assyria being the world power, the Babylonians are kind of on the rise as well. They are eventually going to become the world power. But at the time, they were up and coming, and they hear that Hezekiah was sick. They hadn't apparently heard about the miraculous recovery yet. And so they come to him bringing gifts and a letter, trying some good diplomacy moves. And so what Hezekiah does when he sees them and they come is he decides to flex on them. Verse 13, he welcomes them. He showed them all the treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious oil, his armory, and all that was found in his storehouses. There was nothing in his house or in all his realm that Hezekiah didn't show them. So he decides to take the envoys, the ambassadors, from a world power who's kind of taken over people, and he shows them all the stuff that the kingdom has. He shows them the whole treasury. I almost envision this Scrooge McDuck like diving into his gold that he's got stored up, and he's just taking them and showed them, look at all this stuff he has. And why would you do that? Why would you take the enemy into your storehouse and say, look what all I got? Because God told him, you'll live 15 more years, and the Assyrians won't overtake your kingdom. I promise you, they won't overtake it. And Hezekiah says, well, if no one's ever going to take it from me, I'll just show it off to everybody. What can they do to me? And so Isaiah comes to him in verse 14 and says, what are you doing? Why did you just bring the enemy right in here and show them all that we have to plunder? Why would you do that? And he says, well, I just wanted to show them everything I had. There's nothing in my storehouses I didn't show them. So verse 16, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. Even some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be made eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So Isaiah tells him, no, maybe they're not going to take the kingdom from you, but everything you have is going to be lost. All the sons that you don't have yet, you're going to have sons in the next 15 years. But they're not going to get to grow up and be kings like you. They're going to be taken off by Babylon, and they're going to make them eunuchs so they can serve in the court and they can trust them. Everything you have is going to be taken from you. And Hezekiah's response should have been a great weeping, crying out to God, saying, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done this. But look at what he says. In verse 19, then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord that you've spoken is good, because he thought, why not, if there'll be peace and security in my days? He's only concerned about himself now. He's like, yeah, that was a bad thing I did, but hey, I don't got to suffer for it. Everybody else will have to suffer, but I will be just fine because God has promised me nothing bad will happen. What we do with the answer to our prayers is just as important as asking for them in the first place. Maybe, like Hezekiah, it's health. Maybe some of you have faced a great health scare recently. We've been praying for you all. We kind of know who some of you are, and there's probably others besides that. But you've had a health scare. You've been at death's door. You've prayed to God. We've all prayed to God. God has granted you some more health. What are you doing with it? Are you using it for the glory of God? Or are you squandering it? And maybe it's not health. Maybe it's your financial situation. Maybe it's a job situation. Maybe you were struggling at your job. Maybe you were unhappy. Maybe you couldn't provide for your family like you wanted to. And you prayed, and you prayed to God, and you prayed to God, and He gave you what you were asking for. What are you doing with it? Are you giving it to God? Are you showing glory through God through your answered prayer? Maybe it's children. Maybe it's insert blank. Are you using it for God's glory? Or do you become content and not use it like you should? Hezekiah becomes this warning that if we aren't good stewards of the answers to our prayers, what's the legacy we'll leave behind? Because this is the last story for Hezekiah. Verse 20, the deeds of Hezekiah and all of his might and how good he made the pool and the conduit. All this stuff happened that you can read about. Verse 21, he slept with his fathers. But his story ends on this low note. This story ends of after he died, things being taken off into captivity, sons being turned into eunuchs, and he seemed content with it because it wasn't him that was suffering. What kind of legacy are you leaving with what you do with God's gifts that he's given you? What are you doing with him? If you would, please pray with me. To our almost kind and loving and gracious and righteous Father, Lord, we are thankful that you are a God who hears, a God who hears our prayers, and a God who answers our prayers. But Lord, I pray this morning that when we do receive the answers to our prayers, and you do bless us because you do each and every day, what are we doing with those? Are we being good stewards? I pray that you give us the strength and the mind to look to you, to bring our problems to you, and when you answer, to take those things that were problems that you've turned into positives and use them to your glory. Use them to witness about what a great and powerful God you are. Help us not to be like Hezekiah, to be content to just live out our lives and not worry about what comes next after us. Help us to focus on what you've given us and use it to its full potential to give all the glory to you. And Lord, we know we won't always do this, but help us to be able to see when we don't, to course correct, and to come back in a way that's pleasing to you. So in your son's name, I ask this prayer. Amen. And that's the life of King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah had some great moments, but it also didn't end well. You can start strong amidst dysfunction. Maybe you're at a spot right now where you haven't been willing in whatever arena it is, in this church, in your home church, in your work, in your home, you haven't been willing to take the steps forward because there's so much that needs to be fixed. One of the things we have Millie sing to us comes from Daniel Tiger. A little jingle that says, when something seems hard to do, try it a little bit at a time. If you've got problems and there's a long list of things you think needs to be fixed, one problem at a time. Start working on it. Just because it starts dysfunctional doesn't mean you can't change it. Whether it's work, home, church, whatever it may be, you could turn those things around. Revival takes courage. If you have taken inventory and you've decided that this church or a different church, wherever you go home to, your home needs a revival, it takes courage. You're going to step on toes. You're going to tear down some bronze serpent that somebody really loved. But Hezekiah was willing to do it if that's what it took. Prayer should be your first response, not your last resort. And finally, what kind of legacy are you leaving? Normally when the preacher's kids get brought up in a sermon, it's not normally always a good example, but this morning it is. Titan is a very skilled baseball player. If you've got a chance to watch him play, he's an excellent pitcher. He's a pretty good catcher. He plays first base pretty well. But those aren't where his skills are most needed on his baseball team. He is a constant encourager. He is a constantly going up to teammates and telling them, keep your head up, do a good job. I watched him once this past fall. He probably doesn't remember it, but a kid at short had made an error. And Titan was pitching in the game. After the play was over, he gets ready to get back on the mound, and he sees that he's got his head down. Shortstop does. Titan steps off the mound, walks over to him, tells him to get his head up, he'll make the next play, goes back to the mound like nothing happened. Probably meant nothing to Titan. I can tell by his face he doesn't remember it. But I bet that kid did. I bet that kid's parents did. I know Titan's father did. That becomes a moment that lasts far longer than that baseball game or that season. Unlike King Hezekiah, find a way to give something that continues long after you're gone. Don't just be content with, well, I know the church is probably going to be here the rest of my lifetime. Doesn't look so great after that, but you know what? It'll be good for me. Are you leaving it in a better state than you found it? Think back to when you first came to this church, if you're a member here. Some of you have been members since this morning, as we announced you. Or you've been members here for a few years, or a few decades, or even back in ye old 1900s. Like, you've been here for a while. Is the church in a better state than when you found it? Is this congregation in a better state? And if not, I pray you have the courage to knock down the bronze serpent and find a way to make the church set for when long after you're gone, not just being concerned with your lifetime. This morning, maybe you haven't been a member of the church. Maybe you want to do that this morning. Baptism is something that we can do this morning. We can add you to the Lord's church. Maybe this morning, something from the story of King Hezekiah has made you realize you're not doing something right. That maybe there is some revival needed in some area of your life, and you don't know where to start. As Cliff leads us in this song, don't stand up. Just sit down and pray to God as the rest of us sing. How are you going to be like Hezekiah and lead a revival in whatever area you see it needs to be led?